for me. This is the Al Lewis Show, and I'm Al. How you doing? I got a fantastic show for you today. Yes, the tax man cometh. This is the end of the fiscal year 2005 for a lot of us, and we're starting to expect our W-2s in the mail in a few weeks. We'll be getting those in, and we'll either be wanting to get back some of what they've already taken, or minimize what more we have to give, or we could follow the law. What is that law? Well, my guest coming up on my show in a few short minutes is going to have a lot of interesting information for you about the tax law. He wrote an amazing book called Cracking the Code, the Fascinating Truth About Taxation in America. And so far, people who've read his books, he's trying to keep a track. I've taken back well over $642,000 back from the government. So this is some really heavy-duty information that not everyone knows about, and so we're going to go ahead and give him a jingle in just a sec. So I'm going to see what other... Here's a song by the Nashville Session Players called Taxes. We'll see what their take is on it, and in the meantime, I'll just get him on the phone. So here we go.
Song of taxes, working class cancer sore, tea in Boston Harbor, and Revolutionary War, of giving to the rich and taking from the poor. Sing a song of taxes, let's even up the score. Sing a song of taxes in the presidential pew. Throw in greased senators and corrupt congressmen in the brew. Add a depraved governor, the Education Regency Board, a few greedy city council members, and Attila the Hun's great horde. Let's all tax the trucker for driving down the road, and tax the company janitor for cleaning the commode. college student for learning how to think, and tax the hotel maid for scrubbing out the sink. Don't overlook the waitress for serving up the food, and tax the exotic lady for dancing in the nude. Let's tax the faithful mother for bringing up her son, and tax our country's children for chewing bubble gum. Put a tax on entertainment, cigarettes and the liquor store. Raise sales tax, shift the burden to the homeless and the poor. Sing a song of taxes, fight illegal wars for oil, slash aid for the veterans, big out on the corporate spoil. Privatize Social Security, fill the purse of the Wall Street whore. Reduce firefighters, police, and the planet's health, just ignore. Build some Mimex missiles and a B-51 or two. Ring the world with laser weapons, paint them all red, white, and blue. Print up some cardboard money, who cares if we all go broke? Who'll notice it's our fault when the planet goes up in smoke? Supply-side neo-con men with a trillion-dollar rip-off scam. Give the poor half a cup of water and the rich grand coulee dam. Borrow from our children's future on the backs of the working class. Buy the wealthy a few more yachts while the rest take it in the ass. Tax us up every orifice, keep giving us the screw. And next time the vote comes round, find out what the people can do. Run your pork fat butts out of office, put your family on the welfare line. You'll be in some federal hole, bottoms up doing hard rock time. Sing a song of taxes at the U.S. National Bank. Open up the vaults, clean out the septic tank. Cry out from the gutter, beat on your garbage can. There's a God in heaven up above, save us all from the tax man. Sing a song of taxes, working class cancer sore. Be in Boston Harbor and Revolutionary War. Of giving to the rich and taking from the poor.
We're all mad as hell and we ain't gonna take no more.
Let me just fade this thing out right here and fade you up.
And on the line we have Peter Hendrickson. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Alan. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining me on my show.
My pleasure.
All right. Let me just see if I can get my thing so I don't sound so terrible. All right. I sound better now. Okay. Welcome. I'm still in awe of the book, and maybe I won't be in awe for much longer once I actually put it into practice.
There you go.
but I'm a little nervous. You know, I read your book, in April of last year, and I had already sent in my my paperwork, mm-hmm. and so I didn't want to do the back taxes thing. I thought I'd just wait a year and get brave, but this year I'm gung-ho. I got my my printout of my 4852 form, and anyway, but we'll get to that. I want to talk to you a little bit about your book and about what's up with the truth about taxation, and so maybe we could start by just saying, how did you come about the information that you write in your book, and how did you research your book, and what's going on with the history of it?
Well, the information in the book is essentially what the content of the law that includes the statutes at large going back to the original enactment of the income tax in 1862 and proceeding up through the formation of the codes, which are merely representations of those statutes. There have been a few statutes enacted subsequent to the initial 1939 code, and in fact there are occasional enactments every few years. Those enactments constitute statutes at large themselves. They also are incorporated into the current code. So while the vast bulk of what we know of as the income tax code or the Internal Revenue Code, currently in the 1986 version, reflects laws passed in the latter part of the 19th century and throughout the early part of the 20th century, there are a few portions that are more modern than those periods.
Okay.
As far as the research is concerned, a lot of it is a matter of, you know, pouring through musty old pieces of paper in law libraries, but happily, also a good deal of it is done digitally on a computer, thanks to the fact that much of this information, much of the statutes, and certainly the code itself, are all digitized at this point. In fact, I make them available on a CD, and they're easily searched and investigated. So. So it's a combination of, you know, a little bit of shoe leather and a lot of key punches.
Cool. Well, the gist is of the book is basically a matter of word definitions. It seems to me like
definitions are key. They certainly are an important element of the way the law is. You know, law is two things. There are two key elements to law. One is context.
Mm-hmm.
And one is definitions.
Okay.
And context establishes, in broad terms, the things and people and territories to which a law applies. Definitions refine the application of that law within that context. And it's unrecognized by many people who haven't had occasion to study the subject, but definitions in the law are often wildly different from the definitions of homonyms of those legally defined terms that we're accustomed to use in everyday language. The tax code or the tax law, the revenue law, incorporates a number of those, amongst them wages, employee, employer, trader, business. Income itself, in fact, is a term that has a meaning in the context of revenue law that is completely different from the meaning that we ascribe to that to the word of a similar sound that we're accustomed to use in everyday speech. In everyday speech, we use income to refer to all that comes in,
right.
Just receipts in general. In the tax law, it's a much, much more narrowly defined concept. One referring to put it explicitly, the benefit of the exercise of federal privilege or federal prerogative measured by the dollars produced in that exercise. It's a little bit further defined as well to be the profitable benefit of the exercise of federal prerogatives measured by dollars.
Federal prerogatives, what is that?
The federal government is what I will refer to as a corporate entity, and I say that a little reluctantly because there are people who have a tendency to kind of view that as a pejorative concept, the idea of the government as a corporation. But it really is, it's corporeal in the broad sense of the term. It is a corporealization of the polity. In other words, it is a formal entity that has a legal existence, a real legal existence, allowing it to sue and be sued and to act and be acted upon. And this is a good thing. It's not some kind of a nefarious Illuminati scheme.
Mm-hmm.
It is a good thing. If it weren't a corporeal entity in that legal sense, we would have no way of gaining redress from it if it were to harm us in some fashion. There wouldn't be anything to sue. As it is, it has a real existence in a legal sense.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence of that, it also has rights. It has ownership rights. It has property rights. And it is able to do the things, exercise the powers that we assigned to it, the powers that we delegated to it when we created it as a people. And those constitute its prerogatives.
Okay.
So when we created this government, as in the case of when we created the state government, we gave up some of our own power, some of our own claims to these governmental units, and in part this was to provide them with substance so that they could do the things we wanted them to do, and also it was to provide them with means of raising revenue, means of financing their behavior. In a lot of ways, you can think of the creation of a government and the assignment of authority in this regard as a family that, you know, has a kid grow up to a responsible age, and then they take a portion of the family farm and they give it to that kid and
right.
say, this is yours now. Here's where you can raise your food. Here's where you can here's some property from which you can earn a living.
Okay.
And we did the same thing with our governments. We give them certain territorial ownership rights. We give them certain legal ownerships, and they're able to use those to finance their activities. In the case of the federal government, it has a series of prerogatives. It has certain authorities. It has the ability to run a post office, for instance. It has the ability to control the items crossing our national borders. It has authorities to maintain a court system. And it has the ability to charge fees and impose taxes associated with all of these things. It has the power of eminent domain, and it has the power to create profit opportunities because of the exercise of that power. Being involved in doing these things profitably constitutes activity that the government, federal government, has a legitimate claim to a part of, and it exercises that claim by way of excise taxes. Excise means a piece of the action.
Okay.
And the federal government is entitled to claim a piece of the action of any profitable endeavor that involves its own property. Just much as in the
sure.
case of if your neighbor sets up a lemonade stand in your driveway, you can legitimately claim
okay.
a chunk of the profit.
Right.
Or he can set it up on his own property.
Okay.
Those are his choices. But if he's going to do it on yours, if he decides that you've got the better curb appeal, you've got the better spot for that lemonade stand, he's got to work with you. He's got to be willing to kick 5, 10, 15% your way to let this happen.
Okay.
The federal government is exactly the same. If you see an opportunity to do something involving its powers or its property,
I see. Right.
It's entitled to grab a piece of the action.
Sure.
And it does by way of excise taxes.
And that's an indirect tax.
Excise tax is an indirect tax.
Right.
That's right. It's a tax that is imposed on a voluntary activity and essentially on the exercise of a privilege of some sort.
And but the Constitution forbids any direct tax, correct?
The Constitution forbids a direct tax unless it's apportioned on the part
okay.
of the federal government only, by the way. Important distinction.
Oh, okay.
The state governments are not subject to that limitation. But the federal government, the Constitution says in two places, the only thing that's in the Constitution in two places, it says that direct taxes can only be imposed by way of apportionment. Apportionment means that the government can establish a tax, it can impose a tax on a thing, and when it has done so and has totaled up the whatever that adds up to, it then applies the tax, it divides the tax among the states based on their proportion of the national population. So that, for instance, if the federal government were to impose a tax on windows, say it put a $10 tax on windows, and we had 100 windows in the country.
Okay.
So we have $1,000 total. The $1,000 would be divided up among the states based on their portion of the national population.
Okay.
With, Maryland, or a better example, Wyoming, owing $10, and you know, Michigan owing 100, maybe.
Okay.
Or New York owing, or California owing 100.
Sure.
And all the gradations in between. And that amount would be due from the states, by the way. It would not be due from the citizens.
Okay.
It's the states that pay a portion of direct taxes.
Okay.
And they would raise it from their citizens one way or another. And how they did so would be up to them.
Okay.
But that's the only kind of direct taxation that the federal government is entitled to impose.
So then how do we have this thing called the income tax?
Well, the income tax is an excise tax.
Oh.
It's a tax on a privilege. It's a tax on a voluntary activity,
uh-huh.
which is to say the activity of exercising a federal prerogative. Nobody is forced to do that. No one has to or can be forced to engage in using a federal power to make profit. So that tax passes muster.
Okay.
So it doesn't need to be apportioned because
right.
it's not a direct tax.
I understand. So when you get your 1040 and you're looking at your W-2s and everything and you're saying, okay, in the little box 1A it says these are your wages. When that says wages there, what do they mean by wages?
Well, wages is a defined term in the law. There are two definitions
okay.
for wages. But in both cases, they refer to the remuneration paid to a federal worker, either a worker directly for the federal government or for a federal instrumentality or agency or the officer of a federal corporation.
Okay.
Wages in the federal revenue law do not mean earnings. They don't mean pay for labor.
Okay.
They mean explicitly remuneration paid to a federal worker or office holder or the officer of a federal corporation.
Okay, so I don't work for the federal government in any way.
Good for you.
Yeah. So when I look at that, that number must be wrong. Like on the W-2 that I get from my employer, that's an incorrect number.
You have an employer?
Well, I have someone who I labor for, and they give me...
There's a company you work for.
There's a company I work for, and they give me money for that labor.
Right. Yeah, I very much encourage right. people to
alter language.
Break the habit of using the term wages, employee,
uh-huh.
employer, what
okay.
have you, when referring to themselves, unless they really mean it the way the revenue law defines it, because it becomes very difficult to keep...
Right, okay.
Engage in a meaningful dialogue when you're... You know, when those
Thank
things
you.
Are coming up. So,
all right, I'll try to keep that in mind in our conversation tonight.
So you work for a company.
Right.
And they issue an information return, an affidavit,
right.
which is what a W-2 is, claiming to have paid you wages in a given amount, by means of which they're attesting to two things. The W-2s are executed under penalties of perjury, and they're attesting to two things. They're attesting to an amount, a dollar figure.
Uh-huh.
They're also attesting to the legal character of that amount. They're not just saying we paid Alan or whoever X number of dollars. They're also saying that those dollars constituted income as that term is meant in the revenue law.
I see. Okay. So there's two things they're saying with that W-2.
Two things, that's correct.
Okay. So I get that in the mail and I go, well, okay. So since I've read your book and I've looked in at the real law there that says wages mean payment from
just these limited things.
Yeah, these payment from the federal government or these types of things. Then I go, well, so that's not true, but I still feel like I want to be clear about we should follow the law in submitting a 1040. Or whatever,
Well, a 1040 has a couple of different purposes.
Okay.
And yes, certainly to the degree that anyone is required under the law to furnish one, they certainly ought to do that.
Okay.
Among the purposes, there are two fundamental purposes to a 1040. One is to respond to allegations of the payment of income to
okay.
the filer.
Okay.
Such as in the example that we're talking about, the W-2 that you were referring to, somebody is alleging the payment of income, and we'll consider that income to have quote marks around it because it is income in the legal sense of the term, not income in the common word sense of the term. So they're saying that that a payment was made in a given amount with the legal character of a tax of reflecting a taxable activity, reflecting engaging in a taxable activity. That's the meaning of the legal portion of that. So one of those purposes for that 1040 is to respond to that. The response can take the basically three forms. It can take the form of acknowledgement, which is to say, yes, this is what is being alleged here is true. I endorse it. I agree with it. I'm going to record those figures in the appropriate places on the form where it asks me how much income I was paid and go move on from there, do the calculations and so on and so forth.
Right.
So, follow the procedures. That's one of the response mechanisms. Another one would be to modify that allegation if it was true to some degree and untrue to some degree.
Uh-huh.
And the third would be to rebut it outright if it was entirely incorrect.
Okay.
In any case, the 1040 is the same form for those purposes.
Okay.
And then the other category of purpose for a 1040 is to claim refund of taxes erroneously or incorrectly withheld or collected.
All right. Okay, so in your research, you have found a way to rebut this these claims successfully?
If those claims are incorrect?
Right.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, unsurprisingly, the government itself produces forms, just as it produces forms for acknowledging these various things, it also produces forms for rebutting or correcting erroneous information on an information return, such as a W-2.
Right.
Or a 1099, both of which are categories of what are known as information returns. For the sake of the of those listening, they may not be familiar with this. An information return is different from a 1040 style return in that an information return is not a declaration of liability. It's not a self-assessment form. It's just a form by which information about a payment is transmitted both to the government and to the individual about who, with whom the return is concerned, in order to give them notice that testimony about them has been furnished to the government so that they can respond accordingly.
Oh.
So,
okay. Okay, so let me just use myself as an example because I'm going to be doing this in a few weeks. I'm pretty clear that I haven't had any kind of remuneration from any kind of or any kind of profits from the federal government, and so I get these what I consider erroneous statements from my from the person who I work for, the company that I work for. They say that states that I made X amount in quote wages. How do I then repair that information and take and is there a way for me to get back the money that's already been withheld from me?
Well, as I just said, there is a form. The government produces a form. Specifically, it produces a form to address erroneous W-2s. That's a form number 4852.
Okay.
Again, that form is explicitly for the purpose of correcting.
Okay.
Erroneous W-2s and also erroneous 1099-Rs.
Okay.
The title of that form is Substitute for Form W-2 Wage and Tax Statement or Form 1099-R, Distributions from Pensions, Annuities, Retirement, or Profit Sharing Plans, IRAs, Insurance Contracts, etc. So that's the form intended for that purpose.
All right. So would I then, I'm just, would I, okay, I have this form 4852, and it says enter wages, compensations, and taxes withheld, and then A, da-da-da-da-da, goes through the thing. So I would then fill this out according to how I see it to be truthful statements. Would I submit this alone, this form alone, or would I submit it along with
That form is intended to go with a 1040.
A 1040, okay. It's to be attached to 1040, okay.
In fact, it says so right on the title of the form.
It says right on the top. Okay, so I would fill out this plus a 1040. So that'd be my correction to the W-2s that I received from the person who I work for. Okay. I just need to get clear. Maybe I'm just being selfish, but I know I'm going to be going through this myself, and I want to. And maybe my audience might get courageous and do this too. Okay.
Yeah. This is, of course, discussed in fairly considerable detail in Cracking the Code: Fascinating Truth About Taxation in America.
I read it months ago, and I've been sort of looking at it again just in the past couple days. But
sure.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what the Internal Revenue Service, what kind of responses one might expect when you do this. I know one of their favorite words is frivolous, and that's part of their arguments that against you and other people who point out what they're
doing. That is one of their favorite words, although the most common response of people who file on the basis of what they learn from Cracking the Code, if it's done properly and correctly and accurately, the typical response is simply receiving a check for everything that they're claiming as a refund, which would typically be every penny that had been withheld from them, including Social Security, Medicare, etc. It is true that a few people encounter kind of speed bump behavior from taxing agencies. Obviously, it's kind of counter to the taxing agency's mission statement to be, you know, giving money back. Their mission is to bring in every penny of revenue that they can, by hook or by crook, and they strive hard to achieve that mission, even if it means fudging the facts a little bit, and even if it means making efforts to discourage people who learn the truth about the matter and discover that they really didn't need to have been handing over or allowing to be kept some 30% to 40% of their earnings every year over their lifetimes. So yes, they will occasionally try to thwart a filing, and sometimes frivolous is part of the effort. And this actually goes to another misunderstanding of definitional elements.
Okay.
The word frivolous is used, I think, because it has a connotation to suggest silly.
Right.
As though, you know, what you've done is silly. Uh-huh. What you've done is...
has no merit.
Ridiculous and meaningless.
Right.
And we don't have to pay attention to it.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, frivolous is also a defined term in the Internal Revenue Law.
Oh, is it?
Frivolous has a very explicit definition. It refers to a type of return which is self-contradictory in nature.
Huh.
It isn't a type of return that is contradicted by, or theoretically, or potentially contradicted by, external evidence or external elements, things not on the return itself. It is only a return that is self-contradictory. In other words, a return that makes a claim mathematically, which isn't supported by the data that is included with the return, or a return that makes a claim that is contradicted specifically by something that is included with the return. Those are the two components that constitute a frivolous return. So it is common to see that word used, but it is rare to see it used correctly.
I see. Okay.
And in fact, the IRS in particular, it varies a little bit amongst the states as to how explicit this is or how it's formulated, but the IRS is actually instructed by the law to issue the refunds when they are properly made.
Oh, okay.
Or when the claim is properly made. It really has no choice about the matter. It doesn't have the latitude to decide that it's going to disallow them or decide that in some way or another it can delay them or hinder them. It is, the law says that the government shall issue the refund.
Okay.
However, there's a little bit of a quirky element with the frivolous concept, and that is this: if a return actually were frivolous, the IRS has the power to treat it as unfiled at all, and therefore they're not under an obligation to incorporate its evidence into the record in the first place. And so the claim and the rebuttal of the allegation on the information return that's being addressed by 4852, for instance, you know, that type of a situation, doesn't ever show up in the record if that return is handled that way. And so it is a favored position to declare a return to be frivolous and not process it, not enter it into the record, and then kind of ignore it, ignore the claim. So that response does happen occasionally. It is not a response that has any hope of longevity, because in fact the return was made and the legal obligations of the system, the legal obligations on the government, are established at that point. But it is a discouraging and delaying tactic that provides a pretext for sometimes pretty lengthy delays, and sometimes obliging people to jump through a few hoops.
So I noticed in your I received your newsletter that you sent on the internet, the email, and you said that this year they haven't returned your refund yet.
True.
So you're still waiting?
I'm still waiting for 2004. Yeah, okay. It took about 7 months for me to receive my check for 2003. And so while this current situation, we're now looking at about 9 months at this point, maybe slightly longer than 9 months. According to the service, my return is still under review. But we are well past the point at which my ability to sue has arisen, and that very possibly will be the next step in this process.
Now, the community of folks that have read your book and have acted on your book, you refer to them as warriors,
absolutely, they are warriors on behalf of the law.
And I'm kind of wondering what kind of you say generally there's a check that gets cut and they get
the vast majority of the cases. That's
right.
Exactly right.
So, but on those that they get some kind of speed bump letter or something like that or some kind of long delay on a refund, or is there what I guess I just have a question about the efficacy, how effective this is in real terms. What your returns have been, what the success rate has been, and what kind of legal
the vast majority of readers simply receive their money back.
Okay.
The vast majority.
All right.
The place where some variance occurs mostly involves people who have some kind of clutter or baggage from past years.
I see.
That is in play, and those situations provide some pretexts for the tax agencies to stretch a little further in their delaying tactics and so forth. But people making clean, unencumbered, straight up, correct filings are being treated lawfully for the most part.
Okay. Which brings me to another question I have I was talking to a friend earlier this year about taxation, and he was telling me his woes of wage garnership, garnering, or I don't know how you say the word.
Garnishing,
thank you. Yes, they're garnishing his wages. I was wondering, so I actually gave him a copy of your book, and I don't know if he's read it, but
well,
now he can't whine to me anymore about his problems, because I'm like, well, I've done the best I can do. But
yes.
I'm kind of curious what recourse someone who's already been through a very difficult audit and a very uncomfortable garnishing, and you're still in it. They're every paycheck, they're taking a bunch of your money, and so it's like, how does one sort of alleviate all that past baggage with IRS?
Okay, it depends.
Right.
And that is exactly the kind of case that I was referring to of people who have stuff hanging in the past, either because they had not filed for years, they filed shift style zero returns while still clipping the information, the W-2 information returns right on the thing, and
right.
and so producing a self-contradictory return, or any of several other possible complicating elements. Here are some basic principles. If the evidence on which an ongoing circumstance is based changes, the circumstance or the consequences of that situation have to change also.
Oh, I can.
In other words, if someone is being subjected to some collection activity based on the state of the evidence in the record 3 years ago, and the evidence in the record changes,
right,
then those activities, the basis for those activities also changes.
Oh, okay.
Now, that said, there is also some procedural realities that have to be taken into consideration as well. And those are that there's you can't go back forever and count on responsive or count on proper responses to changes like that. Sometimes when enough time has gone by, sometimes when enough things have happened, either signatures have been put onto documents or statutes of limitations have expired or what have you, sometimes it becomes too late to effectively go back and change that reality.
Okay.
And that's just the way this is.
Right.
So, and there actually are fairly few situations where that's going to be true, or at least where it's going to be hard and fast. The further back the thing is, the more complicated it is, the stickier a situation it is as far as making changes is concerned. But there are going to be a few that are going to be written in stone, others that are going to be simply, written in concrete that's still hardening, and some are going to be in a real thicket that's going to be tough to wade through and see through. But anyway, those are the that's the way that several of those different situations are going to play out. Some are going to be impossible to deal with, others are not.
Well, thank you for that. Really clears it up for me. I was really wanting to know about that. I have just a real sort of, I don't know, maybe it's, here's a question for you. What do you say to folks, just middle of the road, liberal or sort of normal conservative folks that say, well, we got to pay our taxes so we have roads. And I mean, with taxes are, we might not like where all the money goes to. But
taxes are the price we pay for civilization.
Right, and who's gonna take out the trash, and who's gonna?
Actually, I say that that respect for the rights of our neighbors is the price that we pay for civilization. But that said, I'm not in disagreement that we don't have to finance certain group activities.
Okay,
and I'm all for financing group activities. I don't want to live where I'm the sole source of the protection for my family from any roving gang of thugs that wants to wander down my street.
All right.
So I'm all for an organized polity, and I recognize that involves financing some group activities. However, first of all, we don't need to presume those financing activities to be involuntary and conducted by force.
Okay.
As I mentioned earlier on, the federal government, like all governments, has been provided with its 40 acres to generate revenue with. Yep. It has powers that are unique to it that it can exercise. Those are powers that have a value, and we will all shop in their store. And happily provide them with money and revenue because we want the benefit of some of those powers. Beyond that, the Constitution provides for some mechanisms by which the federal government can properly raise revenue, even by taxes, even in a somewhat involuntary way. as discussed earlier, it has the power of direct taxes, which are unquestionably involuntary taxes. It just has to do it by means of apportionment.
Right.
Apportionment is a process that is not very well looked upon by the political class, by Congress, because it involves a great deal of accountability. I personally view that as an enormous plus for
me too.
That type of taxation. A direct apportioned tax in the constitutional mode requires that the things being taxed are specified, that the expenditures for which the tax is laid are specified.
Uh-huh.
It's a one-shot deal.
Right.
It's not an open spigot into the federal treasury where the only thing they have to worry about is how they spend the money.
Uh-huh.
They have to get up and vote in a recognized fashion for this. And if Congress wants to put a bill on the floor saying that it wants $2.3 trillion next year in order to build bridges to nowhere in Alaska, among other things, and wants to stand, each member of Congress is going to stand up and vote yes or no for that kind of money and for those kind of expenditures, I say go for it. We'll see whether you have your job next year.
Yeah.
But it's a fine thing to do, and they actually could do it. They could say, you know, right now they're saying that they have to have $2.3 trillion from us in order to keep things running.
Yeah.
Well, then there should be no great harm or problem with getting up and saying so cleanly and clearly and telling us what you're going to spend the money on
right. And
asking for the money. Theoretically, we've all agreed that this is what we want to spend, right? This is a government by the people, for the people, and all that.
Right.
So in theory, these are our wishes being carried out, so there shouldn't be any problem with making it up front, with standing up and saying, this is what, you know, you want us to spend, here's what we're going to spend it on, you know, give us the money.
Right.
Okay. I don't think it'll happen. I don't think we'd agree that $2.3 trillion makes a whole lot of sense.
No.
If we actually were given the choice, if we actually were given the opportunity to vote on it or at least vote the rascals out right away because we saw what was going on
and
realized that we could. But that's one mechanism. Another is a revenue tariff. Between those two techniques, an occasional direct tax, about a dozen of them, and a steady revenue tariff, that's how the federal government financed itself for the first, a little better than 100 years of our existence. In other words, about half of the history of the United States.
Huh.
Revenue tariff is just a couple percentage points or up to any percentage that is uniformly laid on all products coming across the national border. And its purpose is exclusively to finance activities of the federal government. It's not protectionist. Doesn't favor one industry over another. It's even. And again, that was the way we financed all federal activities the vast majority of the years up until the early part of the 20th century. So the federal government has ways of keeping the roads paved and the judges in black robes.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. I was telling my uncle, I was at a family reunion, and I was telling my uncle about your book, and it was just pretty funny. We were talking about politics, and then I just jumped into this whole thing about cracking the code, and he just had this blank look. Of course, he had been a Washington, D.C. resident for his entire life, pretty much, and worked for Library of Congress for a while, and, you know, and he just kind of, he just blanked out. Like, he went into some other, he went somewhere else. We were just totally engaged, just like, you know, snapping off to each other, talking blah, 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 back and forth about politics and, you know, foreign policy, blah, blah, blah. Then I started talking about this information, and he just went totally blank, looked at me for about 5 seconds blankly, and then got up and left without saying goodbye.
Well, you know, we're all accustomed to grumbling and complaining about the way things are, and carrying on, and maybe even, you know, discussing just how those deck chairs could be rearranged on the Titanic. But but when you start talking to somebody about actually doing something,
right.
it's a different ball game. It's threatening. Yeah. A lot of people find it really, really threatening. I think the issue is that if you actually understand the limitations of the law, you're faced with a moral conundrum. You either have to act,
yeah,
or you have to become a hypocrite.
Right.
And, you know, it's kind of the, you know, an honest man who discovers he's been mistaken either ceases to be mistaken or ceases to be honest. So it's tough stuff.
Yeah. It is. It's really tough. And I just... Since you're making quotes, I thought I'd throw this one in. I found your book by Frederick Douglass. This goes, find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you have the exact measure of the injustice and wrong which will be imposed on them.
You bet.
And that one just really...
Absolutely true. And, you know, it's the frog in the pot.
Right.
an old analogy that... been around for a number of years. You know, how do you cook a frog? If you just drop the frog into a boiling pot of water, you won't cook him because he'll just jump out again immediately.
Right.
But if you put him in a pot of cool water and then slowly raise the temperature, he will stay in there until his muscles are cooked and he can't jump out any longer.
Yeah.
And that's the measure. That's the careful balance of injustice and oppression that we'll be subjected to for as long as we put up with it. And as long as we are complacent, as long as we are the sleeping giant, you know, Gulliver on the beach,
right,
and we just allow these little strings to be laid on us, as Patrick Henry said, you know, are we going to just lay here until we're bound hand and foot? Is that going to be better? Are we going to be better able to defend ourselves at that point? We have to act.
Yeah.
And, complaining is good. You know, policy prescriptions are good. But the law doesn't defend itself, and the rule of law doesn't defend itself. The Constitution doesn't defend itself. It's been bruited about a lot over the last week or so. We've been reminded that some people view the Constitution as just a piece of paper. And, yeah, you know, that really is all it is.
Was that attributed
Americans
to George
stand
Bush?
Behind it.
So, wasn't that George Bush who said that?
I think it was.
Yeah, just a piece of paper.
And not just a piece of paper, but a particularly unpleasantly described piece of paper. But in any case, it is just that unless we stand up and stand behind it and make it something more. So yeah, that's our job as Americans.
Yeah. It just seems right now it's like that we are at their last moment of choosing either to jump out of that of that water or not.
Oh, we really are, aren't
the,
we?
The federal government is just so completely out of control, and every day it just becomes more and more clear to me that that's what's going on with this House approving the extension of the Patriot Act, for example,
yes,
just today.
Yes, a very good example.
Yes, and it's just continuing down that road. So I'm like, I'm really excited. I'm thinking about buying some more books just for some Christmas gifts, last-minute Christmas
gifts.
Do
it. They make great Christmas gifts,
yeah,
and, you know, there's a there is a Christmas special still going on.
Oh, yeah?
You know,
tell us about that.
Get that dozen and get a free I Cracked the Code T-shirt.
Oh, okay. And that's at LostHorizons.com.
That's
right?
Correct.
And it's a lot of interesting stuff there. It's not just about the tech stuff. You've also do a whole homeschooling section there.
Yeah, we've got some information on homeschooling up and a number of other subjects as well.
Mm-hmm. Which is really really interesting to me. My daughter's 2.5, and
so you're getting there.
Yeah,
won't be long.
She can recognize some letters and stuff, and sings the alphabet song. And
well, I hope you're planning on teaching her yourself, you and your wife.
We would like to. We would. Yeah.
It's easy, and it is the most rewarding thing you can do. And frankly, you know, to turn a kid over to a government school.
No, that's not an option.
It really isn't. It's not an option for anybody that gives it any thought.
Well, I mean, I'm a product of those schools, and I can
well,
tell
sure,
you
I am too.
That my education is crap, and it wasn't until I got out of the school system that my education really started.
Yeah.
And
well, I'm glad to hear that you've got that on your radar screen and are giving it some thought.
Yeah, yeah, we'd like to.
Outstanding.
But I'd really like to just encourage everyone. I have one more question, really, one major one. It's like, okay, so I'm looking forward to this when I finally get my my W-2s and I'm going to proceed with all this, and I expect to get the full refund that has been withheld from me already.
Uh-huh.
But I'm kind of wondering, at that point, I'll be emboldened, I think, to then do my some back tax. And, or do you think, is that, I mean, how far back should I, you know, like, what, should I just go for, like, 2004? Or should
well,
I mean, what kind of advice would you give?
I can't tell you what you should go for.
Okay.
As you know, I don't do that. But I will tell you this.
Okay.
There is a statute of limitations as far as how far back one can claim an erroneously or incorrectly withheld tax.
Okay.
And it essentially, for all practical purposes, it's 3 years.
Okay.
And there also is there are other considerations that obtain there as well. I think highly of the notion of correcting an erroneous evidentiary record, but one's expectations should be low. The Supreme Court ruled back in the 20s, or maybe it was the early 30s, that once a tax is voluntarily paid, in other words, once somebody has signed their name on a 1040, self-assessing or acknowledging a liability, they have no legal recourse to forcibly rescind that decision.
Got it.
So that's where the voluntary part came in there. If you voluntarily paid that tax, it's a done deal. You cannot go back and say, "Oops, I made a mistake. You know, I want to take it back. I want my money back." You can't do it. At least you can't do it in a court. You can ask, and I have had readers, not merely a few, but a fair number, get money back on that basis of doing an amended return and correcting evidence that they themselves had endorsed in their original filing, and have gotten their money back.
Okay.
But it isn't something that they could have forced in court. It's kind of, you know, if the secretary wants to give it back to you, he can give it back to you.
Right.
But it can't be made to happen.
Okay.
So and it is, you know, important to understand that there are two factors there. One being the Supreme Court's declaration regarding the voluntarily paid tax, and the other is that it's a more complicated situation because you are essentially contradicting your own previous testimony. That doesn't mean that you can't do that. I mean, you can. Obviously, your testimony changes all the time in all kinds of venues. But it provides additional extra pretext material for a tax agency who definitely does not want to give you your money back, you know, all other things considered, to be more uncooperative in that respect. So just, you know, I'm not saying that to discourage anyone. As I said, I like the idea of correcting bad evidence.
Right.
If bad evidence exists, it really should not be allowed to stay on the record. But it also should be understood that it is, you know, going to be a tougher row to hoe.
Right. Have you gotten any media attention at all with your book? I mean, I know you've been on my show once before, but other than that...
And I love your show, Alan.
Oh, thanks.
It is growing. It has been not, you know, Bill O'Reilly hasn't had me on his show yet.
Okay.
But it is increasing.
Good.
Sort of out of the mainstream stuff, but it's increasing. You know, the fact is the book's profile is getting bigger rapidly. My website routinely does 1.5 million hits a month now. More than 1 million pages are downloaded from the site every month.
The book is
being read on 4 continents at this point. It's in libraries across America. It still has not yet seen the inside of a bookstore anywhere in the country. The bookstores just are—they consider it to be radioactive. It seems.
Wow.
I've talked with Borders and Barnes and Noble both, and in both cases they won't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Huh.
So, just one of those things. But as time goes by, all these things change.
Right.
And that's kind of the trend at this point.
All right. Well, so when you get your refund back from following the advice in this book, just buy one for your local library.
Buy one for your local library. Send me a scan of your refund.
Yes. Oh, yes. Right.
Absolutely do that, please. It is. It makes a lot of difference to the next person down the road to see each of those refunds. You know, currently I have $642,000 worth of checks posted on my website that people have received back over the course of the last 12 months or so. The amount reported to me, but unfortunately not evidenced by a scan or fax of the check itself or the notice of refund, exceeds a couple of million dollars at this point.
Wow.
It makes a lot of difference to be able to post that evidence. So please, everybody listening, please send me those scans, send me those faxes.
Cool. I had a small little question, sort of about, you know, I don't know if it's competition or just other people who are talking about very similar things, notably like Shirley Peel Jackson, people like this who...
similar at all, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, well, see, I've just heard like a couple of her speeches where she was like challenged to find the code where it says that, you know, or, you know, what the, you know, these things about definitions and things. And so I'm just curious, how does what's in your book differentiate itself from other websites or books or people out there who say what maybe appears to be similar, but is...
There are a lot of things that are superficially appear similar, but nothing that actually is the same information. And that's not to say that a lot of people haven't successfully deciphered elements of the picture in the past, because they have. The difference is the kind of the unified field theory.
Okay.
Component where it all is brought together in a complete understanding of the way the law is written and the way the law is structured, and so you know there's no question that a lot of wonderful and productive research and work has been done over the years. It just was, you know, a lot of good examination of the trees without a complete, you know, apprehension of the forest itself.
I see.
You
know,
that's all I can say.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Peter. I really appreciate taking your time and talking about this, because I think it's really the best tool we have right now to undercut this Leviathan federal government that's just completely out of control.
Yep. Let's keep the money out of their hands.
Yeah, exactly. That's their we acquiesce our dollars and then they take away our rights.
Yeah, they spend our money on supervising our every waking moment.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
All right, Alan, it's been a pleasure.
All right, thanks a lot, Peter.
You take care.
All right, bye bye.
All right, bye bye.
So. Make sure to go out there to losthorizons.com and buy his book. It's great. I totally recommend it. It's only $19.95. Such a deal. And so you know you want it. And buy some for your friends. Buy some for your library. Buy some for a bookstore. No. Well, I mean, if you're a bookstore owner, buy it. So anyway, it's great. And the commercial's over. Let's see. I was going to play something else. Oh, there was that one. Oh, yeah, I know what we need. We need some Johnny Guitar Watson, because it's a good song, and it's about the dollar bill.
Well, let me tell you something here. Now, this is something that we are all a victim of. Sometimes we let our eyes get us in big trouble. Listen. Don't let your eyes get bigger than your pocket. No. Because if you do, why, your business is out of socket. Yes, it is. Listen. Here's why. You got to have this ass. If you want to pass the test, no matter how your loved one feels, you got to do what's best. And don't try to be no big deal. Dollar bill, dollar bill, dollar bill. It's all about the dollar bill.
Yes, it is.
maker. I'm your future troublemaker. I'm the guy that used to date your little sister. I'm the resistor. Now you can spin your little stories till nobody will believe you anymore. Your deadly schemes and say it isn't what it means, but let me tell you what it means. This means war.
That was Carl Klang with a song called The Resistor. And I like Carl Klang. He's pretty cool. I thought that he has this really great song about taxes and stuff. I thought it was in this computer, and I was going to play it, but it's not in there. So, yeah, so I guess Bush did call the Constitution just a goddamn piece of paper, as reported in Capitol Hill Blue. So, there you go. It's kind of wondering why more people just aren't, like, out on the streets. But, you know what? Actually, it's funny. Today at work, a guy who I would have thought was a total Bushite was just, like, going off about the government and blah, blah, blah. I was just like, damn, dude, I didn't know you were that cool. Shoot. And, anyway, we're going to keep the music rolling, just chill out a little bit. Thanks for listening to Radioactive San Diego here on the internet at radioactiveradio.org. There's going to be a, if you're in San Diego, there's going to be a benefit beer party for the folks of 106.9 FM who are needing money, but they're... doing a clandestine, illegal, supposedly illegal operation by running a non-licensed FM signal. And they happen to stream our internet stream on the FM, which is very nice for us that we get more listeners that way. It's also very nice for them because they get to help out, but they don't have any money anymore. So come over to Sparky's. That's 1521 30th on December 17th, starting around 8 o'clock. There's going to be $2 Pabst Blue Ribbons on tap. And so that's how you buy a Pabst Blue Ribbon. That $2 is going to go to 106.9. So how can you go wrong, right? So I'm kind of really curious how Filner voted on this House approves extension of Patriot Act story. The House voted 251 to 171 to approve the House-Senate compromise that would modify and make permanent most of the Patriot Act's 16 expiring provisions, but a group of Republican and Democratic senators lobbying for more time to add additional safeguards on the law. Oh, shit. President Bush urged against any delay in Senate action. Quote, the Patriot Act is essential in fighting the war on terror and preventing our enemies from striking America again, he said in a statement. In the war on terror, we cannot afford to be without this law for a single moment. Oh, geez. You know what that means? It means if it doesn't get passed, we'd be in trouble from these fucking terrorists. All right, so we're going to keep playing some music. Let's see what else we got. Oh, I love these guys. This is that Kanono number 7. So I like it, so maybe you will too. There you go. jam, huh?
Okay.
Yeah,
thank
it is.
You, macho. Thank you. Thank you.
Hello, hello.
Sweet. Isn't that sweet? Oh, love it. All right. It's amazing stuff out there in the world. Hey, you know, I found this quote by Ariel Sharon. You know, the guy, the Iranian guy, he got in a load of shit because he was calling the Holocaust a myth. And then he said, so here's some more of what he said. I said that Israel should be, quote, wiped off the map. Okay, wipe off the map. And then Wednesday, for the first time, he publicly denied the Holocaust. Touring southeast Iran, Ahmadinejad said that if Europeans insist the Holocaust happened, then they are responsible and should pay the price. Quote, today they have created a myth in the name of Holocaust and consider it to be above God, religion, and the prophets. Ahmadinejad also told thousands of people in the southeastern city of Zahedan, quote, if you committed this big crime, then why should the oppressed Palestinian nation pay the price? He asked rhetorically, quote, this is our proposal. If you committed the crime, then give a part of your own land in Europe, the United States, Canada, or Alaska to them so that the Jews can establish their country. So he says, you know, why if you're going to have Israel, go and make Israel over, you know, where these crimes happen, all right? So anyway, so then I found this quote here by Ariel Sharon, which is amusing. Quote, if I became a prime minister, I would wipe out all Arabs, killing every newborn Palestinian baby and knife the abdomen of every woman who is pregnant from an Arab. Those dogs should not be close to the chosen people of God. Wow, that's Ariel Sharon. Here's another Ariel Sharon, ready? Genociding the Arabs and killing them are the only weapon in dealing with them. There will not be peace between us and the Arabs as our future. Us and the Arabs as our future is built only by wiping them out. Keeping one Arab alive in the region is a dagger in the back of Israel. So, meanwhile, Israel approves building of hundreds of new homes in the West Bank settlements. This is an AP story. Israel has approved construction of hundreds of new homes in West Bank settlements, the defense ministry said Wednesday, confirming what would be a violation of the U.S.-backed peace plan. So, wow. All right. Kind of. So there you go. Rest in peace, Tukey Williams. That's all I got to say about that. Sorry about that, dude. All right, well, I'm out of here. I'm just going to wrap this show up right now, call it a day. Let's see, I'm going to go out with something. You know, I saw this thing, a Noam Chomsky little thing, and it's pretty short. I'm going to play that, and then I'll play a song, and then I'm going to go home. This is some kind of Noam Chomsky thing. Now, I like Noam Chomsky, okay? He's not all that in a bag of chips, you know. I saw this thing. Oh, here it is. It's a minute-long ditty on taxes so it's on the topic. So I thought, well, this might be interesting to see what Noam Chomsky has to say about taxes. So here we go.
The next element of the Washington consensus is making the tax system more regressive. Okay, we don't have to talk about that. It's stated openly. The thing that isn't stated openly is the reason. This is supposed to be in order to increase investment and give everyone jobs. But it's a really weird way to do that. I mean, the country is already awash in capital. The people whose taxes are being cut don't know what to do with their money. If you want to increase growth, there's another approach that might be used, stimulate weak demand by progressive taxes. That is, put more money into the hands of people who can spend it. That increases growth. That would increase growth. But that's not the right way to do it. The right way to do it is by cutting financial gains so that you can have more speculation against currencies. So that's the second part, make the tax system more regressive. What about deregulation?
Gee, I wish I would have had Mr. Hendrickson on the phone for that one. Regressive? Dude, I don't know. How about just not even there? That's from an album of some kind of thing called Free Market Fantasies, Capitalism in the Real World. Anyway. All right. I was going to play some music. How about this? This funny one. This is Douglas Thief, November 2003 in E-flat by the New Horizons in Violence.
Why is it wrong for dictators and terrorists to kill innocent civilians, and right or excusable for the United States to do exactly the same?
Well, the United States doesn't do it, and if we did it, it would be as reprehensible as what the terrorists do.
The United States doesn't kill innocent civilians.
No, the United States does not target civilians.
Those of us on the outside who look at September the 11th, where 3,000 people died in that tragedy, but then look at the thousands who have died since, wonder about double standards in it. Would you address that?
I think that the numbers that you're talking about are questionable. So let's leave aside your numbers.
Why are they questionable?
I mean, I don't accept your assertion that we've killed thousands of innocent people. I don't know that that's true, and I don't accept the assertion, and I don't accept the assertion. I don't know that that's true, and I don't accept the assertion.
Well, I don't want to get into numbers. But certainly thousands. Thousands seems a fair figure.
I don't know that that's true, and I don't accept the assertion. And I don't accept the assertion. I don't know that that's true, and I don't accept the assertion.
Mr. Fife, that sounds fine, sitting here in Washington. But in Iraq and in Afghanistan, which is my most recent experience, that's not how it works at all.
May I interrupt for a moment? I apologize, sir. Would you stop tape, please, for one moment? Thank you very much. Let me know when you stop tape.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry, I'm doing this purposefully, sir. Have we stopped it?
This is very serious.
I was not under the impression, sir, that...
Mr. Fife's minder, an army colonel, suddenly stopped the interview as I had pursued the question of civilian deaths.
I agree.
Civilian deaths, 10 or 100 or a million deaths.
Yeah.
Mr. President, what has to happen...
And the answer is, you're wasting your time to try to promote democracy. I think it is impossible. Get rid of the processes that would enable them to develop democracies to promote peace. And I believe we have a duty and an obligation to kill people in brutal fashion to stop it.
That helps a lot, I think. But I think the president said something here that I really think is very, very important. I mean, why would they want a democratic form of government? Because in the end, the people want another dictator, a strong-armed leader who's going to have the secret police. You know, why wouldn't they?
The new leaders of NATO walk in the room.
The greasy pole and all the rest of it.
You know, I'm all for conferences, just as long as the conferences produce a nuclear weapon.
Mr. President, first, the Prime Minister is your poodle. I was wondering if that's the way you may see your relationship.
Let's see here. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right.
Right.
Absolutely.
Good job. Thank you, sir.
All right. With that, I got to go. So thanks for listening. And hope you all have a fabulous, fabulous day. And don't let the fascist chimps get you down, right? Okay. Love you.